Musings Podcast with Fairbairn and Russell. Hello and welcome to the Market Musings Podcast, where today we're talking about the medicinal cannabis space, again, as we're welcoming Hannah Deacon and Professor Mike Barnes, who are directors and founders of Mapletree Consultants, who are a consultancy who advise key stakeholders in the medicinal cannabis and CBD space in the UK. So, welcome to you both. Hannah, let's start with you. I know you started with a campaign. You're very welcome here. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Thank you for having me.
It's good to have you on the podcast. And Mike, how are you? Doing okay as well?
Yes, fine. Thank you. And thank you for asking us.
Good, good, good. And of course, finally, but not least, we have Kenny.
Yep, I'm always here, Mark. Yep, it's great to have both of you on. And I'm really looking forward to this podcast because it's a sector that I don't know a great deal about, but I'm sure going to give me all the information that we need, and our listeners are wanting as well. So, yeah, welcome to the podcast. And as we spoke earlier on, the whole point of this podcast we'd like to find out about the people behind the companies, you know, how your journey to the company, you know, what is your background, what was your education, you know, what was your career like, etc., stuff like that. So it maybe be great if we could maybe start with yourself, Mike, maybe give us a bit about your sort of background, your sort of potted history of Professor Mike Barnes and how you ended up at Mapletree.
Good. Yes, thank you. That's a challenge. Potted my life in the space of 2 minutes. I'll do my best. Well, I was brought up in East London in Walthamstow. I went to school in Walthamstow and then went off to university in Bristol to study medicine, which wasn't my first choice, actually. I wanted to do biochemistry, but as soon as I got doing biochemistry as part of medicine, I realized that was a mistake. So I probably chose the right career path in the end. And then I worked my way up and became a consultant neurologist and then a professor of neurological rehabilitation. And I chose that, which is sort of slightly relevant to the cannabis space because neurologists traditionally in the UK are very good at diagnosing things. They're diagnostic experts for brain and spinal cord and nerve injuries, but they're not very good, they weren't very good at least, in actually managing people with long-term disabilities. Once they made the diagnosis, went back home and a little support, much of that. So I moved into what was then a brand new specialty of neurological rehabilitation, dealing, helping people in the long term with their sometimes incurable and often very disabling conditions, and then moved finally into brain injury and spent the last 5 or 6 years of my working life in people with traumatic brain injuries after car accidents and such like. In the context of that, I began to specialize a little bit in the management of spasticity, that's muscle spasm after stroke or after brain injury, and pioneered, I think you could say, the use of Botox. Of course, its primary use of Botox is not, as we hear about today in the magazines, about cosmetic treatment of wrinkle lines. It was actually first came out as a management of severe muscle spasm like spasticity and helping people with those sort of disabilities. So I did a lot of that. But of course, I was working in spasticity. I was approached by a company called GW Pharma, now something like 20 years ago, probably, to help them with the development of what turned out to be the first cannabis medicine called Sativex. Mm-hmm. And I helped to get that through the regulatory process to get it licensed as a medicine. It was never much used in the UK because NICE, which was in the early days then, perhaps about 15 years ago, decided it wasn't really cost effective and shouldn't be used in the NHS. So I didn't really do much more with cannabis until about now 5 years ago, yes, 2016, when I was asked to do a report for a government body called the All-Party Parliamentary Group on Drug Policy Reform. And I did that with my daughter, and we reviewed all the articles about the efficacy and safety of cannabis in all sorts of medical conditions, and that was published as the Barnes Report. And I suppose that pushed me a little bit into the cannabis limelight. probably as a result of that exposure, if you like, I was then approached by a guy called Peter Carroll and the End Our Pain campaign, which Hannah, which you'll hear about in a moment, and her son Alfie were pushing quite rightly for cannabis to be legalized so that Alfie could obtain that on the NHS. And finally, that campaign was successful in the summer of 2018. And I think as a result of that, the law changed for cannabis in November 2018 and was doctors on the specialist register, so called hospital consultants, really, were allowed and still are allowed to prescribe cannabis. And that was a great day. And we thought that was the job done, really, but we realized very soon that actually the National Health Service wasn't going to prescribe cannabis and still isn't, except for three children. And we carried on with that campaign, and I joined together with Hannah now about 18 months ago, I think, to form Maple Tree, as we were asked to do a lot of consultancy work combined with campaigning to get cannabis more recognized as a medicine and more recognized nationally and hopefully prescribed on the National Health Service. So in a quick nutshell, that's how I came to be what I am at the moment. I think I wouldn't call myself a neurologist anymore. I call myself a cannabis physician, as that's all I do these days, is various consultancy and setting up clinics and campaigning and helping companies get into the UK, helping companies in the UK get their cannabis licenses and such like. And it's very exciting, very interesting time. And that's how I came to be where I am now.
Right, that was great, Mike. I think just for the benefit of our listeners, could you maybe, well, you're highly qualified, so you're probably the best person to explain it. You know, what can medical cannabis be used to treat? I mean, there's a wide...
It can be used a lot. I mean, a little bit of background. It works largely, not exclusively, but largely through our own body's system called the endocannabinoid system, which is a sort of, if you like, a master controller of all nerve function. And of course, our nerve function controls everything we do, our thinking, our sight, our hearing, our taste, our heart, our bowels and bladder, moving our arms and legs. The nervous system controls everything. And the thing that oversees, controls, modulates all those nervous systems is called the endocannabinoid system, which is not widely known and not widely taught even these days in medical school. Cannabis, the body produces its own, if you like, cannabis molecules called endocannabinoids, which interact and make that system work. And all cannabis does is interact with that system. The so-called phytocannabinoids from the plant interact with our own endocannabinoid system. And because the endocannabinoid system really controls every nerve function, cannabis can have a huge variety of different useful functions. And people sometimes say, well, you know, it must be some sort of snake oil because it can't work for everything. But actually, when you realize how it does work, controlling all the nervous system functions in the body, then it does have a role in very many diseases and symptoms. And the best, most researched is for the management of chronic pain. It's analgesic cannabis, generally. Very helpful for chronic pain, and about two-thirds of people in the cannabis clinics now are prescribed for pain. The second useful function is anxiety, anxiety in the context of things like PTSD or just proper psychiatric anxiety. It calms people down. It's very good as anti-anxiety, and about 20% of the people in the clinics, that's its use. Then, of course, is anti-epilepsy, and we'll hear from Hannah in a moment about how remarkable and almost miraculous it is for some children and adults who are with epilepsy. It's very good at nausea and sickness after, say, chemotherapy. It's remarkably effective. It's probably the most effective anti-nausea, anti-sickness drug known to man. And they're the main indications, along with spasticity, of course, which was the earliest indication I mentioned earlier. It does a lot of other things with perhaps less evidence base at the moment, like helping people with Crohn's disease or ulcerative colitis, for example. So it potentially does a great deal, but the five things that it really helpful for and is really now being prescribed for is pain, anxiety, epilepsy, nausea and sickness, and muscle spasm, spasticity. And there's unarguable evidence for that, conclusive evidence for that.
Yeah, I didn't realize there was as many applications for medical cannabis. That's really fascinating. Yeah. So, as Mark, have you do you want to jump in? If you get anything for Mike before we move across to Hannah's story?
No, I think let's bring Hannah in. I had lots of questions, but let's let Hannah give a chance to sort of introduce and see who she is, who you brought, wherever you come from, Hannah, and then we can sort of discuss in more detail.
Okay, so I come from Brighton originally, so on the south coast. I grew up there, and basically I did A-levels in marketing, and I worked for Brighton Hove Albion Football Club, which was really good fun. And I worked in travel as well. I went travelling around the world for about a year when I was 22, but I didn't really have a career, let's say. I had a lot of fun, but not much of a career. And then I had Alfie when I was 32. I met my partner and moved up to the Midlands, where I live now, in Kenilworth, which is near Warwick and Stratford, so right in the centre of the country. And I moved up here and we had Alfie. And then, my life changed forever, really, being a mother anyway. But then when he was 8 months old, he had his first seizure at home. I remember the date. It was the 27th of May, 2012. He had a huge tonic-clonic seizure. We took him into our local hospital. And sadly, he became very, very chronically ill with hundreds of seizures back to back. We ended up at Great Ormond Street Hospital. He was on a life support machine. He'd been having seizures on this life support machine for 3.5 weeks. They had tried everything. They had done every test under the sun and they couldn't find anything wrong with him. They told us that he would likely not survive because he was having such an onslaught of seizures. But they tried to give him intravenous methylprednisolone, which is a steroid, and that actually stopped his seizures. So they diagnosed him with immune responsive epilepsy and basically sent us home to rehabilitate him. And he'd lost every skill. He was sitting and babbling before this happened to him. He was like a newborn baby. It was a very, very traumatic experience. But his seizures stopped, and we hoped, very much that they thought it might have been an isolated response to a virus or to a pathogen or anything within his body, because he just stopped having seizures as soon as we gave him steroids. But sadly, that wasn't the case. And 8 months later, he had another very severe cluster of seizures, which lasted for about 2 weeks. And that carried on until he was five, when the seizures started to come every 3 weeks. So every 3 weeks we would have to, the seizures always happened at night. So sort of 2-3 in the morning, we'd be woken up by a tonic clonic seizure, him screaming, which is the presentation of his condition, and rush him into our local hospital. The older he got, the more aware he was of what was happening to him, because the seizures weren't knocking him out like they were when he was a baby. So we were having to hold him down to get IVs into him. He was very, very distressed, very traumatized, and so were we, as his parents. So it was a very, very traumatic time in our life. And by the time Alfie was three, we also had a little girl called Annie, who thankfully is very, very healthy, but that still put a very big amount of pressure on us as a family to have another child. So in the Christmas when he was five, he was diagnosed with a condition called PCDH19, which is a very severe epilepsy which clusters. So he doesn't have seizures every day, but he has these very big clusters of seizures. It causes mild to severe learning delay and can cause very severe behavior problems in later life, such as schizophrenia and very, very severe mental health problems. But it only affects girls, so it's on the X chromosome. So usually obviously girls only have the X chromosome, so they get very severe seizures. There's about 25,000 girls in the world with it. It can affect boys very rarely when it's on the X chromosome, but only in some parts of the body. So the Y chromosome can't take over the function of the gene. So Alfie is one of 9 known diagnosed boys in the world with his condition. So when we found that out, we realised that actually the doctors knew nothing about Alfie's condition, and they didn't. And when he first became ill, I just assumed, you take your child to hospital, the doctors make them better and you go home. And that really wasn't our experience. The doctor said to us, we will just have to firefight and hope with age that he'll grow out of it, or get better with age, not grow out of it, but get better with age. And when I heard that, I just thought, well, no, you know, I'm not going, I couldn't live like that. It was very traumatic for our family. I didn't want to watch my child die in front of my eyes. So that was when we had the diagnosis and his condition got a lot worse. And by the time he was moving into being six, we were having seizures every week. So 150 severe seizures per cluster. We were going into hospital, filling him with drugs, getting the steroids into him. Within 3 days, the cluster will have stopped. We went home. We then had 3 or 4 days of severe violent behaviour. So hitting, kicking, punching, screaming, crying, anger. I mean, he was just absolutely off his face on withdrawal of steroids and the drugs that he was given, and obviously the amount of seizures he'd had. So his quality of life was really poor, really, really poor. We may have maybe had 1 or 2 days where he was a bit happier, and then he'd go into another cluster. And our quality of life in turn was really, really poor. So I was a full-time carer to him for nearly 7 years, which really affected my mental health as well, because it was incredibly difficult for all of us. So in 2016, I just decided to find something that could replicate steroids, and cannabis just kept coming up as a very effective medicine for epilepsy. William O'Shaughnessy documented its first use in epilepsy in the 1900s, I believe, and that just really spiked something in me. And then I contacted parents in America who had children with PCDH19 who were legally allowed to use cannabis alongside anti-epileptic medication, and it was very effective. And I just thought, well, if I've got to bury my little boy, I need to know that I have done everything in my power as his mother to fight for him and to get him the treatment he needs. And we did try to get on the Epidiolex trial, which is a CBD isolate product that GW Pharma were trialing at the time in 2016. And Alfie was refused that trial due to his condition, wasn't the criteria they were looking for. So I decided to take him to Holland. And in 2017, after raising money and starting a change.org petition, we started a campaign called Alfie's Hope on Facebook. And I blogged a lot on there and vlogged on there about being the parent of a disabled child and why it was important that Alfie had the right to use this medicine. In September 2017, we went to and lived in The Hague and had a doctor there, a pediatric neurologist, who prescribed Bedrocan products for him. And it was our miracle. And I don't want to band around miracle, but it was our miracle. You know, he stopped having seizures for long stretches of time. And that was amazing. You know, it is no cure. He still has to take anti-epileptics. He still has very difficult days sometimes with autism and with behavior. But we don't have severe medical emergencies every week. It means that I can work. It means he can go to school. It means his sister's quality of life is much better, and my partner's. So it changed our lives. But obviously, we were stuck in The Hague then. And our doctor, our NHS doctor, was very, very supportive, our paediatric neurologist. He wanted to prescribe, but because it was a Schedule 1 drug in the UK, his trust told him that sadly he wasn't allowed to support us, which was very, very upsetting for him and for us. So that's why we had to embark on a campaign, which we started in February 2018. We came back to the UK. We took Alfie off the medicine that worked for him, sadly, because we didn't want to break the law. We wanted to work with government to make them understand why this was an important medicine to be available to people like Alfie. And we worked with End Our Pain, as Mike said, with Peter Carroll, who runs End Our Pain, which is a lobby group on medical cannabis on prescription. And I met the Prime Minister in March 2018, who allowed our doctors to apply for a licence. And that's how I met Mike, because, as I said, our NHS doctor was blocked from helping us. So Professor Barnes saved the day in the sense that he worked with the Home Office for 3 months, made that licence application. And with a little bit of media pressure, we managed to get that permanent long-term license for Mike to prescribe. Well, it was actually for him to direct our GP to prescribe the Schedule 1 medicine that we'd used in Holland. So Alfie has had an NHS prescription for that medicine since June 2018. And when the law changed, as Mike said, I won't repeat it, but we were very hopeful that what we had done. And you know, I recognised there was other families as well that had campaigned on this subject. What we had done as a collective group is help many millions of patients, but sadly that wasn't to be. And as Mike said, I was being asked to sort of support people with developing their patient focus within their businesses. And we just decided to work together because we get on very well and we have lots of fun. And we also are very aligned with this, with our view on where the way the sector should be going. And actually, most importantly, that NHS prescriptions should be available, that actually this is not a pharmaceutical product, this is a botanical. And the government and the bodies such as NICE and the MHRA need to recognise that and create frameworks which keep patients safe, but recognise that it's a botanical medicine and that we can't wait for randomised controlled trials for every compound of that plant to be available, because we'd be waiting hundreds of years before medicines are available, and actually they're not going to be as effective as the whole plant product that you can grow. So yeah, so that, you know, I carry on very much so being a campaigner, but I also feel that if I can use my voice to help the sector develop in the UK for the NHS, also for the private sector, because there will be a required private sector, that actually the patient voice is at the centre of that conversation, because that's how these companies will get it right, as far as I'm concerned.
And so the prescription that you have for your son, Alfie, is that specific to you, or can other people who suffer from the same condition get access?
No, it's specific to Alfie. So right. Alfie is prescribed Bedrocan products via his GP under the direction of a specialist. It's not available to anyone else on the NHS, because the NHS say, and the governing bodies such as the BPNA and the Royal College of Physicians say, because there's no randomised control evidence, that it's not a safe medicine and it can't be commissioned and it can't be funded. So NICE will not recommend its use, which therefore means it's not a commissioned medicine, which therefore means there's no funding pathway. So even though the law changed to allow specialist doctors to prescribe, there is no pathway to access. So even when we see doctors who do want to prescribe, who do see children that have been on private prescriptions for the last 2 years and have either massively reduced their seizures or stopped having seizures for long periods of time, and actually are saving the NHS a lot of money, because inpatients for these children for can be for long periods of time, and that costs the NHS a lot more than them funding cannabis medicines. Sadly, there is just a total block on NHS access, which is why we see this emerging private sector for adults. But even for children in the private sector, there is only currently one prescribing paediatric neurologist, which makes it very, 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 very difficult for parents, one, to get a prescription, but two, to fund it, because it can be, you know, good quality whole plant products that are in the UK at the moment are very, very expensive. So that's why, for me, having that UK sector is so important, because it will bring the price down, it will guarantee supply, and I hope that in time the NHS will become available. But in the interim, we need to ensure that private access is affordable for everyone, not just for people who either have the money or can find the wherewithal in their sales to fundraise, which is basically what a lot of families are having to do, which is really sad when they're very vulnerable already.
It's really good that you decided to go down the, let's say, the legal route and go the campaigning, because that can be drawn out for an awful long time and probably be very frustrating. And I know a lot of people who have basically done it effectively the illegal way. You know, I mean, I became aware of CBD oil probably back in 2013, with my one of my friends who was really who discovered it through Rick Simpson. You probably heard of Rick Simpson. Yeah. People using it to treat their cancer, and I know a lot of people who would, you know, it was a bit shady, but people were doing it because it was their only result. They had stage 4 cancer, and they were doing what they could, and some of them managed to put their cancer into remission, but all of them, as you mentioned earlier, they their quality of life massively improved. People who couldn't do anything post their cancer treatment were out again enjoying life, cutting the grass, you know, and enjoying enjoying life. But it is still a Schedule One drug, which I think by definition means no medicinal use. I don't know if I'm right in that, but, well, but I think that's what I...
It's a Schedule Two if it's classed as a medicinal cannabis product. So you have to fit certain criteria. But cannabis as a flower that's not a medicinal product is Schedule One still in the UK. So cannabis is still illegal to use.
Yeah.
But if you are prescribed a medicinal cannabis product, then it comes under a Schedule Two. So that's what makes it legal to prescribe. So, yeah, I completely agree with you. I think it is very different if it's yourself. I think if you're procuring cannabis to treat an ailment that is for you and yourself, I think then you're taking the responsibility for you personally. When you're talking about your children, you need to be 110% sure that what you're giving your child is safe, that you know what's in it, that you're not being taken for a ride. And also, you know, I didn't want to lose, I did consider it, of course. I didn't want to go and live in The Hague for 5 months without my friends and my family and the support network I had. But, you know, there's too many variables. And I also love my children more than anything in the world, and I didn't want to lose them. You know, I did not want to lose them through being irresponsible. So it's very sad, but actually I helped to run a support group called MedCan Support, which was set up by another parent called Matt Hughes to support parents who want to use medical cannabis for their children or the adults that they care for, their children, you know, adult children. And many of those people are going to the black market, which is incredibly sad. And that's why it's perplexing that the doctors that are blocking access to children and adults in the UK don't understand what harm they're doing. Actually, they're pushing people, because families will use cannabis with their children who have severe epilepsy anyway. They're not going to wait for their doctor to tell them to do it, because they're desperate, because they're at the end of the road, because their support network probably isn't good enough. A lot of these families don't have good enough support from the government, so they don't have respite, they don't have social workers. They're struggling. They're really struggling. And then, so when they hear that cannabis might work for their children, of course, they're going to do anything they can to help their child. And that's why... you know, it's really, really important for doctors to see this as a harm reduction approach. You know, actually, people will do it anyway. So why don't they prescribe these safe products? Why don't they collect the data? Why don't they understand why randomized controlled trials aren't suitable and actually make it safer for people who are going to do it anyway? And that's just not happening. So, yeah, there is a lot of vulnerable families and patient, you know, adult patients out there that are, you know, fueling the black market, which I just find shocking. I don't understand it. Why would the government allow that to happen? But that is what's happening. But
are you finding, though, now that you sort of mentioned it earlier, that doctors and specialists are supportive of these kind of treatments rather than, you know, often we see the headline from the National Health Service, for example, that no, there's no research into this. We can't condone it. But are you finding that you are seeing support there on the ground, or at least understanding that it's there?
I think, yes, I think there's more support than we know. I mean, Alfie's doctors, we've been very lucky with them, very, very supportive people, and really sort of listened to me as his parent and Drew as his parent, and helped us to make this happen for him. Mike and I also helped run the Medical Cannabis Clinician Society, which has over 200 members, all of which are either prescribing clinicians or nurses or doctors or GPs who have an interest or want to see medicinal cannabis prescribed. When we talk to, you know, a lot of these doctors, they're very, very interested. They want the freedom to prescribe, but they're not allowed to. So I think there is an appetite there. But these professional bodies, such as the British Paediatric Neurology Society, the Royal College of Physicians, they are, you know, they've got big clout, let's say, and when they say this is not safe, we do not think you should prescribe it, it's a very, very brave doctor who then stands up and says, do you know what, I'm going to do this anyway. But even if they do, the funding pathway isn't there. So even if they write the prescription, and they do the application to the NHS for funding, the only way they get funding is to prove exceptionality at the moment. And that is very, very difficult when epilepsy is, as if you use the umbrella term of refractory epilepsy, there's about 37,000 children in the country with refractory epilepsy, and that's not exceptional. So it is it's just a long-winded bureaucracy to stop access, as far as I can see it at the moment. And that's really, really unfair. But I do have positivity that there are doctors within, you know, the prescribing world that do want this to happen. And obviously we've seen with the private sector, there's about 60 doctors now, I think, prescribing privately. So that's really exciting, but they're not for children. They're adult doctors. So that's the problem.
Yeah, okay. I mean, do you think it's due to prohibition that the reason it's like almost it is an uphill battle?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I think it's fear. It's absolute fear and ignorance. And as Mike alluded to when he was talking, the endocannabinoid system is not taught to medical students. So medical students don't know anything about the endocannabinoid system. They don't know anything about botanical medicines. They are trained in the use of single compound pharmaceuticals to treat symptoms. And that's the problem. You're butting up against that training with, let's use a botanical medicine that's got hundreds of compounds in. And there's no framework to fit that botanical medicine in. Whereas you look at Holland, they've accepted the exceptionality of cannabis and created an Office of Medical Cannabis where they look at data separately and they accept that it's not a pharmaceutical. That's what needs to happen in the UK if we're going to move forward. And I'm not saying it's perfect in Holland. It's not perfect anywhere. You know, there's lots of problems in Canada still, and they've had 20 years of medical cannabis being available to prescribe. But I do think prohibition is a big problem with it, because people are ignorant and they don't understand why cannabis is so helpful, and if used safely and correctly, it can be a miracle for people. And as you say, quality of life is what's important in chronic illness. It's not about curing people necessarily. It's about allowing them to have a good quality of life while they're here, if they do have an illness which will limit their life.
Yeah, I think it is that fear, that prohibition when you mention cannabis. It's like I live in the Netherlands, I live in The Hague, and you sort of smell it everywhere, and everyone kind of just does it around. But I tell my parents, and they don't like to hear that, because they associate it with sort of bad kind of things. But I mean, it is changing though, isn't it? I think we see changes in the United States, which is I think is positive. Because the United States are always very funny when it comes to these kind of things and putting laws into things. But it's nice to see that they're actually taking some steps to change it. We have spoken to a company in the private sector, Ananda Developments, and Melissa, the CEO of that company, I believe you know very well.
Yes. Anna.
And obviously they are one of the first publicly listed companies to be actually working in this space and hopefully getting a license to grow cannabis in the United Kingdom for medicinal use. So, yes, it is. But it is changing, though. Would you, Mike, what do you think?
It is.
Do you see it getting any easier?
Not rapidly. I think that there have been changes, yes, but it's all too piecemeal and too slow. And we've recently produced a report with 10 recommendations for government that sort of highlights the real importance that the government needs to grasp this opportunity, particularly post-Brexit and post-COVID. And that paper, just very briefly, demonstrated that if we have a proper UK medical cannabis industry, we'd generate something like 100,000 new jobs. That's extrapolated from, as you say, the experience in the States and Canada, where they're a long way ahead of us. It also obviously would generate tax income on the companies making profit, corporation tax. There'll be more people paying income tax because they're employed in the cannabis sector, et cetera, et cetera. And, I think it's better for the government to collect that tax revenue from a good industry rather than put it in the hands of the criminal fraternity who currently supply most of the cannabis in this country. I mean, as Hannah said, there's 6,000 people prescribed legally in the UK. There's thought to be about 1.4 million who use cannabis illegally. And all that money that's generating is going into the criminal market, which seems crazy to me. And that, let alone the recreational market, we're not talking about that today, but 1.4 million people compared to 6,000 legally prescribed is crazy. So that 10 recommendations for government report that was released last week highlights the opportunity in medical cannabis and industrial hemp, which is cannabis as well, of course, to develop that industry and encourage the government to make it a little bit more streamlined, a little bit easier to understand for people to get licenses, which is a problem at the moment, and also to get doctors more aligned and more prescribing. For example, getting GPs to prescribe would be a real boost, because I think GPs are very good prescribers. So there's a lot we need to do. We've come a long way. We shouldn't forget, you know, no more than 200 bit years ago, it was all totally illegal. At least we're doing things now, and the market's expanding and developing, but there's a long way we need to go, and a lot the government could do to help that.
Yeah, and I suppose you sometimes maybe you feel like you want to go to 10 Downing Street and shake some of the people that are there, because it's a bit sad, I think, as well, when it sort of comes back down to money, and that's what you're recommending. You know, it's about how can we make money, but it all comes back
sadly,
to that, doesn't it,
ultimately. Yes. I mean, you know, there's a good solid clinical reason why we should have a UK market, like certainty of the supply chain, for example. It's all imported at the moment. In COVID and post-Brexit, we've seen the problems of getting a supply totally dependent on foreign import. So there's a lot of good clinical reasons why we need to improve this market, but sadly, the governments plural over the years have really responded to the economic arguments rather than the emotional arguments. And so this paper highlights for them the economic arguments.
Yeah, and we were speaking before, Hannah, weren't we, about this? I mean, this could be a fantastic opportunity for the United Kingdom, particularly post-Brexit, regardless of your views on Brexit. The UK has its chance now to do something to stand out in the world.
Yeah. Exactly.
I completely agree with that. And I think, you know, as you mentioned, Ananda, that there are companies that are coming through that are really open to listening to the patient, they want to understand, you know, what makes a good quality product, what we should be growing, who's our patient. And that's really exciting because, you know, yes, we welcome if there's good quality product coming from abroad, that's great. But it's very, very difficult to influence those companies into what we need in the UK. So that, you know, I think it's incredibly exciting to see companies like Ananda who are developing in the UK, because we can hopefully have some influence on the way in which that's going to sort of reflect on patient benefit. And I think that's really, really important. And, you know, I've known Melissa since 2019, and she has been like a bit of a mentor to me, because it is a bit of a lonely place sometimes being a woman in the medical cannabis sector, because there's not many of us, especially not in the UK. There's very many more abroad, but not many in the UK. So, you know, that has been a really, you know, really helpful relationship to me. But I am really excited about the future for the UK sector if the government recognises why it's important. I feel it's really sad that it has to come down to money. As you said, it should be about chronically ill patients and their families having the best possible medicines for their diseases. That's what it should be about. It should be about patient-centred care. It should be about patient-focused government proposals. But I think, sadly, that, you know, that's a bit pie in the sky. What we have to remember is that governments will focus mostly on the financial implications of developing a sector. And I hope that through our paper with Mapletree, they are going to see the benefits of this sector and really help this British development, because it surely that's what Brexit was all about. It was about encouraging the development of British business. And I can't see that happening at the moment. So I hope that we're going to be proved wrong soon.
Is this paper available publicly?
Yes, it is.
If you go on to mapletreeconsultants.co.uk and you can go to the news section, there's a news piece on it, and you can download the whole report. Yeah, you can just put your details in, and it's emailed to you as a PDF.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Good stuff, Mark. I know you were getting really engrossed there, so I was quite happy just to step back and listen for a change. Just going back, just to finish off, I mean, I've wrote it down three or four times because I still can't get my head around about it. So Alfie would have 150 seizures within a cluster, and a cluster would maybe last a couple of days. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
It's just, you know, I mean, I've been blessed with three kids and, you know, touch wood, you know, no major out with broken bones and things like that. You know, everything's been fantastic. But, I mean, I take my hat off to you. I mean, 150 seizures. I mean, mentally and physically, I mean, it must have drained, you know, obviously Alfie, yourself, your partner, you know, your other daughter as well. It's just an astonishing story. In fact, I would actually quite like to get you back on again if you would be up for a sort of separate podcast and just to dig deeper into that, because it's
of course I'm very happy to, and I appreciate you, Kenny, you know, recognizing that, because it's really, really important that people, you know, and that's what drives me, you know, that's what drives me every single day, because I know what it's like to stand next to your child in a hospital wishing that they would live, and it's the most horrendous, grief inducing. Many parents like me have PTSD or very severe anxiety disorders because of what they go through with their children. It's people get PTSD from one traumatic moment. We were living that traumatic moment every week of our life. But, you know, Alfie was in hospital 48 times in 2016, so pretty much every week. It's absolutely horrendous, and that's why I do what I do, really, because if I don't use it for positivity, then it will eat me up, and the grief and everything that we've been through will eat me up. Even though Alfie is a lot better than he was, there's still a huge amount of uncertainty for his future. So I think to use it for positivity, for positivity in my life and others, then it's really, really important. But yeah, it is very hard. It's something that will never leave me, what we've been through.
Yeah. No, it's an amazing story. Mark, we definitely need to make time to get Hannah back on at some point. And Mike, you'll be most welcome as well, because it's a topic you could spend, you know, you could spend.
Yeah, it's a fascinating topic, isn't it? There's so many ramifications to it. So many interesting things will come out of developing cannabis as a medicine in the next 5-10 years. I think it will revolutionise medicine. To be quite honest, I don't think that's an overstatement.
Yeah, I mean, it's close to home, but I do have two sister-in-laws that have lived with chronic pain for about 20 years. I mean, and the drugs that they're on to try and manage the pain, you know, it's like ketamine and all sorts of stuff. It's just horrific. And I think they've tried absolutely everything apart from medical cannabis. So I think they're getting to the stage as well now where, you know, they're both over 50 and they're just like, well, we need to try something else because we can't keep on living like this.
Do you know about Project 2021? Because it might be that they could go on that if you did want to. They did want to think about using medicinal cannabis for pain, because that's a really good project that Mike's the clinical director for, where it's the product is a lot cheaper than if going through a private clinic.
Caps the cost. £150 a month, which still is a lot of money for a lot of people, but it's much cheaper than it has been. We launched it on the NHS, of course we do, as we've been saying, but the 2021 project for certain conditions, including pain and anxiety and others, is capped at £150 a month. So that's much better.
Yeah, I'm definitely something I'll be looking up or speaking to you about after this podcast. But I think, I mean, that's almost about sort of 40 minutes we've been talking. So I think it's quite a good point to end. Mark, have you got anything to finish off with?
No, except I would love to have you, either of you or both of you at the same time again, back on. We haven't really done the whole subject justice in 45 minutes, but you know, it's been fantastic to, as a starter, you know, to get an introduction to both of you and the work that you're doing, and we're only going, to see more of it. And to have you know,
yeah, it's a pleasure. I've really enjoyed talking to you. Thank you.
Yes, thank you very much.
Thank you. Appreciate your time. Have a good day.
Thank you.
Thank you both. Bye-bye for now. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to another podcast from Market Musings with Herb Ben and Russell. Tune in next time.